Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. My name is Katrine, and today we have with us Allison Horrocks, who is here to tell her story. So thank you for being with us today, Allison.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin just with a brief history of your Mormon background.
Okay, I was raised LDS in Northern California, generations going back to Joseph Smith on both sides. I'm kind of proud of one ancestor now. He was an original apostate, so I'm.
Oh, really?
Austin Coles. He was excommunicated for apostasy, and he was in the stake presidency in Nauvoo, and left our church with William Law. Had his testimony in the Nauvoo Expositor. So about
how? Wow.
Yeah. So now he's my hero. It used to be a family secret.
So did he leave over what happened with William Law?
From what I've read, Hiram Smith came into the council meeting and told about polygamy, about this new covenant, and he was very upset about that. So that's why he left his polygamy. And actually, his daughter was one of Joseph Smith's polyandrous wives. So that probably was what prompted him to want to leave. So. But yeah, I come from, by my apostasy, honestly, so.
Good. Austin, I've never heard Austin Coles. I'll have to look him up. That's interesting. You grew up in Northern California.
Fifth of six kids. Very active family. My dad was bishop when I was little. And, just the typical sort of LDS, background, so.
Okay. And when going into teenage, did you like young women's? Was that good for you?
That was a mixed bag. As someone who was, going through some abuse in my life at the same time that I was in young women's, there was a lot of messages that were being told to me that I felt were very shaming but I didn't look at it objectively at that point. I was ashamed. It was tough, but I was also very, would get very into it at times too, where I would just, be reading my Book of Mormon every day, not listening to any music other than, EFY music and Motab, and just trying to, be extremely spiritual. And so, it was back and forth with me. It was interesting. So, yeah.
Okay. You said you had five brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
Were you the oldest or youngest?
I was the youngest girl, but there's one just below me. Yeah, my eldest sister was and is 11 years older than me. And so she went off to Bricks when I was, in first grade, I think. She had issues with, eating disorders and that sort of thing. And so, she was brought back home and introduced to her husband by my dad. It was one of those marriages where it was like something to be ashamed of, where he was LDS, he was a returned missionary, but they didn't get married in the temple. It was in our family room where they had this, my dad was bishop at the time. And, even as a 7-year-old, I remember that being something's wrong here. Something is this is not a joyous event. So, that's kind of where that started. And he wasn't a good addition to our family. Mike, he had, troubled past. He was, had a lot of issues, his teenage years, and it was just kind of one of those guys just he's just a jerk, he just kind of a sexist, always making jokes, and it wasn't like that in my family. We didn't have a lot of, racist, sexist jokes going on. So, it was a different sort of element. There's one story where, they were down in LA and he was going to, I don't even know what you call it, a mortician school. I don't know what you would call that, but.
Oh, I don't know either.
I was 7 or 8 and he took me down. They were living above the funeral home And he took me down to get the mail by myself. And he opened the door of this room and said, look in there, and like pushed me in. And there was a dead body on the table. And he closed the door with me in there. And there's just this one spotlight on this lady. And that's the kind of element I'm talking about.
Wow. That's was the that kind of traumatic guy. For you?
Yes. Well, yeah, I still remember it. It really, it was just, I remember that primal fear and just realizing I freeze when I'm scared. That's what I did. I totally froze and just sat there. Like, if I say something, she's going to hear me and wake up and come get me. So he was just that kind of guy, you know, he just thought it was funny to like, to scare people, to prank people, to just, you know, be that kind of a, you know, that kind of a guy. So he began to sexually abuse me at the age of 9. After he was done in the LA area, they came and moved in with my parents and all of us in the house. And, you know, my sister had a newborn, I believe at that time. And from there, we went through 7 years of sexual abuse that just kind of lasted till I was 16. And, yeah, I mean, he was a active member going to the, you know, temple regularly, that sort of thing. And even once they moved out into their own place, they lived right outside of a funeral home. And, I'd go over and babysit, and their house was, you know, 20 minutes or so from my parents' house. So they'd say, can you just spend the night? You know, Mike doesn't want to drive you all that way tonight. So I would spend the night and then I'd be, you know, that's how it continued once he was out of our house. So yeah, it was a long 7 years. So.
And did it, I don't need details, but did it happen often?
Yeah, and the problem was that, you know, I mean, years later in therapy, I remember feeling so much guilt that why did I go over there? Why did I babysit? Why did I like put myself in that position knowing that something would happen? And she, you know, my therapist at the time, helped me to realize you'd already been, you know, what's the word? Not indoctrinated, but you know, he'd already been in our house grooming me. Already been abusing me, and it was just kind of a continuation. And I really didn't have a choice, but you know, for years I carried that with me that, gosh, it was me. I'm so stupid, you know? But I would do things like his daughter is just 9 years younger than me. And I would go, usually I would sleep out in their, you know, front room, and it was very easy access that way. So I would go get in my niece's bed. And he'd come in anyway. I'm like, really? I can't stop it no matter, you know, what I did or, so it was very extensive. And, he really, what's the term? There's a certain term for it, but he made me feel like I was part of it. Like that I, you know, we shouldn't do this anymore. That kind of stuff where I'm like, what do you mean we? I'm 11 years old or whatever I was at the time. And he would always talk bad about himself, trying to get me to make him feel better about himself. And, he just, you know, just a really negative, awful, you know, source in my family. He's still in my family. So, yeah.
And did you ever tell anyone?
No. Oh my gosh. I used to have fantasies about sitting my family down or my parents or, you know, my mom or whoever down in the living room and just blurting it out. It was such a fantasy for me. I would sit there and dream about it, and I could never get myself to do it. Mike really led me to believe that I'm keeping the family together. And if I say anything, then, you know, everything's going to fall apart. People are going to be, you know, destroyed. So, yeah, I never told anyone. I didn't tell anyone until I was 18. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
In those fantasies, did you ever fantasize how your family would respond to it?
Oh my gosh. Yes. I was sure. I was certain that they would just be like, okay, that's it. He's going to jail. This is over. everyone would be outraged. Everyone would, you know, come in and swoop in and hug me and, you know, and it would be this, you know, sort of love fest on me, you know? I mean, the reality is much different, but yeah, I just thought it would like, and I don't know. See, it's so weird because I fantasized about it being over and him being hauled off to jail at the same time that I felt like I was responsible for keeping everything together. So I don't know how those two concepts like, work together in my brain, but there you go. I wanted it to end. And so when I was 16, I went off to England to be sort of an exchange student with an LDS family. I contacted them through the New Era. And I just went. Just like, I'm out of here. And
yeah. So you just contacted a random family in England and said, I come live with you?
I wrote to the New Era. I said, I'm a Californian. I want to go live there for a while. I want to stay with an LDS family. And they put me in contact with someone who wrote for them, regularly. And she said, okay, well, here's some things you might need to do or be responsible for here. And this is, and so I told her, that we could do that. And so then she volunteered to be the one that took me in, and I'm sure she regretted it. Wow. After I came in, but.
Wow. You've got gumption just to.
I do.
Contact some through the New Era and say, you know, yeah. I want a new place to live. That's yeah, great.
I can't believe my parents let me. I mean, I just flew off as a 16-year-old, just, you know, I'd been on a plane before, but not by myself. And, you know, just flying across a different country. So,
were you glad you did it?
Yes, I was. I still am. It still is a big, you know, it has impacted my life, you know, even today, but I really went a little bit wild there. You know, I think the freedom, like I said, when I was going through my teenage years, there was times when I'd get very, ultra-religious, fanatical, I think that was just to deal with my shame of, you know, feeling, you know, being told in Sunday school that, you know, if you get raped, your virtue is gone. Like, you need to fight till you die. Those kind of messages I would get in Sunday school, and I'm like, oh, dang, I'm already ruined. You know, when you're hearing that as a 10-year-old or 11-year-old or 12-year-old. And so I remember for my 13th birthday, I got I asked for a framed portrait of the Second Coming and to put in my room and like new scriptures. And I just had like this year of just being like, you know, I got my patriarchal blessing really young. I was just so, you know, gung ho. Well, then you fast forward to England where I was free. I wasn't being abused. I could get into pubs. You can get into a pub when you're 16 and have drinks. No one cares. And that's what I did. I went a little wild there and had, you know, started drinking over there. And I didn't do anything. I mean, by normal kid standards, by normal teenage standards, that I really didn't do anything too outrageous. But for an LDS kid, I felt horrible about it, but I still did it. It was just freedom. So. And I, my poor LDS family I was staying with, they probably didn't know what hit them. I was a little bit secretive and kind of would sneak out and do things like that. Cause my family, was never very strict. I didn't, you know, but this family was, they had, you know, rules and this sort of thing. And, they're great people, but I was acting up there. So.
Did you continue to go to church?
Yes. I even went and did baptisms for the dead at, you know, the temple in London, even though like, you know, some of the youth there said, you're not worthy. I heard you drank, you know, like a few weeks ago. And well, I'm stopping now. I'm not going to do it again. You know, that sort of thing. It was a really good experience. And I had dreams. I had fantasies about running away to England. And after I was there, I realized, you know, I'm glad to be an American. I appreciate America now. I'll go back. And when I went back, the abuse didn't restart because it had been cut, you know, the chain had been cut since he had no access to me from the age of 16. So when I came back, it was just weird just seeing him and pretending like things were okay. And then I went wild again. I went even more wild after I got home. So
how old were you at this point?
17. I was just at the end of my senior year in high school, and I got very preoccupied with my appearance and being like, wanting to be sexy or wanting to, you know, that's what I was, you know, good for, sort of a thing, you know? I mean, I remember in Sunday school when I was 15, my Sunday school teacher, this pervert guy, telling me, you know, you're a really pretty lady, you know, things like, you know, like that. We were like, oh, I guess that's what I'm, you know, I guess that's what men want. So I lost a lot of weight. I wasn't big to begin with, but I got down really skinny. I went, you know, tanning, and I would just wear very skimpy clothes. And I had decided at that point I was going to be a sports psychologist. I was going to study sports psychology in school. And so I would go to games and things, and that's where I got into trouble. I started getting dates with professional baseball players and that sort of thing. And when I was 18, I talked myself into losing my virginity. It wasn't some night where I'm like, okay, let's just go for it. It was really hard for me to talk myself into it. I don't know. There was just something that stopped me before. So I had to rationalize it within myself. And then one night we did. And then I don't know, just felt awful. You know, you realize that's not like a big prize. Like I mean, we were sort of a couple for a little while, but that's not something special to him. He doesn't care. Like, he can get that wherever he wants, you know? So
it ended up being something you regretted.
Yeah. I mean, especially at that point in my life, when I still was a believer, where I really, really believed it. You know, as much as I felt at odds with being naturally a Mormon, I never, even as an adult, I never felt comfortable being a Mormon. Like, it wasn't natural for me. I didn't like going to church, but I believed it. So at that point, I just felt like garbage, you know, like, what did I do? I just wasted this thing. I mean, it was already gone as far as I was concerned, but I went next level sort of thing. At that point, I was out after this relationship with the first guy had ended. I was out with a different baseball player and had went to his house and I was date raped there. And I don't know why I'm getting emotional about it. I haven't thought about it for years, actually. But I didn't tell anyone because I wasn't dressed modestly. I was in his apartment alone. I was making out with him. It was my fault. I let him on. So I didn't tell anyone about it till I was married, until my husband. I didn't tell anyone. I just, it was kind of like it was my fault, you know, that sort of a thing. And then after that, I got fanatical again. You know, I was going to go to Rick's and, you know, got some new scriptures and marked them up, getting ready to go to Rick's. And I remember like driving to Idaho and just using my little highlighter and highlighting all this stuff and just being, you know, I'm going to be a Molly Mormon now. And when I got to Rick's, I had a lot of health issues. I mean, I was doing really well in school, but I was just being hit with things. I think I was just getting the effects of all of this buildup of stress and psychological damage and all that stuff was just kind of catching up with me. And, I went to the bishop there and I told him about my abuse, and that was the first person I told, and he didn't do anything about it. He just said, okay, well, here, why don't we have you read Miracle of Forgiveness, which, of course, has the same information about, you know, you should never lose your virtue, to fight for your, you know, with your life, that sort of a thing.
Did you tell him about when your brother-in-law, or did you tell him about the rape, or all of
my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you know, I've noticed how the boys at the ward look at you, and what are we going to do with you till we get you safely married? That was what he said to me. And I was like, what does that mean? Does that mean that I'm causing this? Does this mean that, like, I'm this target that, you know, I have to be safely married? Someone needs to get me to the temple now and, you know, claim me. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know how to take that. But
when you went into the bishop, what did you think would happen? What did you have any ideas or thoughts?
No, I was just so physically, I'm trying to think what my expectations were at the time. I was so physically destroyed at that point with all these weird illnesses and viruses, and knew I needed to go see the bishop. He was kind, other than the weird messages I was getting about it, but he was a kind person. He wasn't, and I told him, you know, I had committed some sins and things like that. But I didn't know what I was expecting. I just felt like anything that any priest and leader said was what was supposed to be said. I never questioned that they could be wrong or that their message was misguided. As a woman, when you don't have priesthood, you don't know what it feels like. So you're like, well, I wonder what it feels like for them. Do they know things? Do they have some sort of discernment that we just don't understand, you know? So no, I just went in, and he was loving, but it was, I think it was, gave me the wrong message for sure.
So that confession, well, I don't know if confession is the right word, the meeting with the bishop didn't go, right. Did it help in any way, or did you regret going to that?
No, I felt like it was, I had done what I was supposed to do, you know, that was a weight lifted off, that sort of thing. And then I started getting sick again after that. I was having some weird virus come through me again. I went home for Christmas, and I started acting up again. I swear, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I never felt like I was a good enough. I could never live the gospel for very long. I just wasn't good enough. And I kept proving myself right back then. There's so much shame and guilt back then. I mean, even now I still feel it sometimes, but so I came home, went down to see a friend in San Diego for part of the Christmas break, had acted out with her, you know, had drank some down there. Nothing else other than drinking, but that of course is a huge no-no. So I fly back up from San Diego up to San Francisco and with my parents, and it was a day I was leaving back for Rick's after Christmas break, and they saw that I was doing things I shouldn't be doing, and they were very concerned about me, and so they sat me down in this, you know, in their bedroom, and were like, what is going on with you? What is wrong with you? You know, and just hammering me, and I'm just sitting there crying, and I didn't know, you know, what to say, or, you know, how to explain myself, and we were in there for about an hour or so, and my dad had to go take a phone call. And when he was gone, it was just my mom and I, and she just said, you know, what happened to you that you're like this? And I blurted out that Mike sexually abused me as a kid. And I don't know where that came from. I was just sick of being blamed for other people's garbage. But I blurted it out, and she was shocked. And all she said was, with how you've been acting, I don't even know if I can believe you. And that was it. That's all she ever said. She's never really said anything else since then. She doesn't talk about it. And it was just like, wow, thanks. So my mom left the room. Went to go talk to my dad, and then they came back in, and he said, is this true, what your mom said? And I said, yes. And he said, do you think that Mike will admit it? I said, yes, I think he will. So I literally had to leave right then as all this was exploding to go catch my flight back to Idaho. And He took me to an LDS bookstore on the way to the airport and got me some, you know, tapes about sexual abuse. And I think it was the Chieko Okazaki one. She did one about sexual abuse. And then, like, sent me on an airplane. I was gone. So I wasn't there for the fallout that happened after I left. But it was a really, so for years, my brother-in-law, Mike, was also physically abusing my sister that he was married to. And she would, you know, leave him, come move in with her kids into my parents' house, like for a week, and then go back. It happened all the time in my childhood. And I'd be thinking, yes, this is the time she's going to leave Mike. This is over. I don't have to deal with this. She would always go back. So I left to go back to Rick's, went back into school for a little bit, got sick again. I tell you, my body was falling apart at this point. So my dad sent me, pulled me out of Rick's, sent me down to Provo to go. What was it at that time? Was it UVCC or UVSC? This would have been 95.
UVCC.
That's what it was, 95. Okay, so that's where I went. My brother and his wife were living in Provo, so he thought I needed some family. I needed to be around family. So I kept waiting. What's going to happen? Oh, this is finally going to be it. He's going to be excommunicated. He's going to be arrested. It's over. And so I, checking with my dad, and he would just say, well, I've told Mike. Mike admitted it. And I said, you really need to go talk to your bishop. He didn't even call the police. It was like, go talk to your bishop. That's the most important thing, of course. And Mike would say, well, I don't want my wife to know. I'll talk to the bishop. I don't want my wife to know. And, I'm obviously my dad said, my dad was like, I think he's going to make it tell your wife. And then I get this call, weeks later that Mike had beaten my sister because she turned off his Nintendo game or something that he'd been playing. I mean, something stupid like that. And he, broke a rib. He had beat her in front of his eldest daughter, who was probably, six, seven at the time. And that's when my dad said, okay, that's it. I'm calling your bishop. And Mike went in and he lied to the bishop. He said that he had had an affair with the babysitter. And so, I don't know, when I heard that, it like hit me so hard. Like, maybe I really am responsible. Like, maybe I am part of it. Maybe it was partly my fault, because, everyone keeps putting blame, shifting blame to me in some way. And even he did, and so,
So was he calling you the babysitter?
And he yes.
Had an affair with you. Okay.
And he didn't say, she was 9 when it started, didn't say, she was my sister-in-law, didn't say any of that. So all this happened, my dad, nothing was happening. Like, my sister wasn't being told, and he didn't know what was going on. He talked to the bishop, Mike's bishop, and Mike's bishop told my dad what Mike had said, and my dad's like, no, that's not what happened. And, they said, okay, we're going to do the church court thing now. And I was still waiting for someone to arrest him, but no one did anything. And at this point in the handbook, they're supposed to call the state. They're supposed to, at that point, 95, 96, that time frame, but, they didn't. I was, sitting in my brother's house knowing that this church court was going on. My dad said, I'm going to be acting as your witness. Which made no sense. He asked me one question about my abuse ever, and it was there penetration? That was it. Like, that's the only question he wanted to know. Didn't want any of their details. So for him to act as my witness, I didn't know how or what that meant, but like I said, I totally bought into it. I bought into the priesthood, and what they say is, you follow it. So plus I was still, pretty much a kid, 18 at the time. So I was waiting at my brother's house, and then I get the phone call, and they said, oh, my dad said he's been disfellowshipped. And my heart just sank. It's like, what? How was he not excommunicated? He's beat up his wife many times, which, by the way, she would go into the bishop every single time she was beat up, and he'd say, stop making him so mad, and he won't beat you up anymore. So, and he abused a child for 7 years, and my dad told me that the bishop said to him, if it was still going on, we would have excommunicated him. And I said, so he gets to keep a secret for years and be a little weasel and be, you know, and not say anything. And that's how he gets away with it. I was mad, but I tried to, downplay it. I tried to say, yeah, disfellowshipment, that's pretty bad. That is bad, right? Like that's not pleasant. I was so indoctrinated. I was so brainwashed by my family, by my experience at church, by my abuser. I was really brainwashed. So.
Was your sister still in the dark at this point?
No, she knew. She just found out. And what I heard from her was she kicked him out of the house for 3 months and she needed time to like think. So she said, okay, I don't want to talk about it for 3 months. I don't even want to ask me if I'll take you back. You know, just no communication. And she actually came out to visit me in Utah during this separation and talked about how he sent her these cards saying that if she took him back, he'd treat her like a queen. I'm like, what? Like, you think that's sweet? That's just, anyway, so the 3 months is up and, in the meantime, I had met my husband. We were engaged during this time after the church court. And the 3 months was up and he just kind of moved back in the house. And I was like, what? I thought this is not what I imagined. Like, I thought it was all going to be over. I thought he was going to be sitting in prison. You know, with the church turning its back on him, but he was fellowshipped hardcore by everyone. Everyone surrounded him with love. And I just felt like I was out and, you know, going, hello, remember me? Can someone love me? Can someone validate my experience here? And then we find out that my sister's pregnant. She had slept with her husband only within a couple of months of knowing what he did to me. And it was just like, wow. I was so hurt and confused and, I've always felt like she's a very, extremely low self-esteem. Always had issues with self-worth and I felt like she took the easy way out, if that makes sense. I feel like she didn't want to make a decision. She didn't want to say, she doesn't have a degree. She didn't have any education. She didn't have any work experience. She was a mom. And I feel like she couldn't imagine going it alone. And she got pregnant to make the decision for her, you know? I still have a hard time forgiving her for getting pregnant. Like, how do you do that with the guy that, you know, has been a pedophile? I don't know. Especially so soon after you found out.
You said they had an older daughter. How many kids do they have?
They have 5 altogether now. She got pregnant with her 5th at the time. So she had 4 before.
Were you worried about his daughter being molested
by him? Oh my gosh, yes. I would talk to my dad about it. I would go to my bishop saying, you know, I'm a little concerned about this. Oh, and I skipped over this one part. I was home for summer break. And my dad had sent me to a, you know, therapist. And she was LDS. And she told me at the time, I have to report this to the state. And I said, okay, fine. And I get home. My dad said, well, how was your session? I said, it's great. You know, she told me she's got to report it. So, and he said, what? No, we have taken care of this. You know, this is between God and Mike and the bishop. And, you know, we are not going to do this. He was furious. My dad can go into these rages sometimes that are, you know, can be quite scary. And his whole goal at that point was protecting the family, protecting the image of the church, of the family. And I was hurt. I was so hurt. I just wanted him to want something to happen to this guy who did something to his daughter. I wanted him to want that, and he didn't want that. He wanted to shut it up. So he called the therapist angry and just chewed her out, and I don't know what happened. I don't know. I have my suspicions about what he did with calling the authorities and trying to squelch it, but nothing ever happened. So shortly after, I got married at 19, so this was all happening, this very condensed, like 18, 19 was a crazy little time for me. And we didn't get married in the temple, even though he was LDS.
Was there a reason behind that?
Yeah, we weren't doing things we shouldn't be doing. So, you know, that was an embarrassment for everybody. And he is just a good guy. My husband's name is Russ, and he's just a very kind, good person. And I kind of felt like I had ruined him because he was just such a good boy before I met him, and you know, grew up in Provo, and his dad was a BYU professor, and you know, he was just this good kid. And but it was very timely when I met him, because if I didn't have this advocate or this person that was on my side, I think I would have fallen apart completely. So we got married in Provo, and it used to be a church house, but it had been converted to, it's like right across the street from a Smith's or something. It was like an old, you know, Mormon church house that was now like a place that did weddings and like parties and stuff.
There's several ones around Utah.
Yeah. It was not a pretty view looking right into Smith's or whatever. But my dad, you know, I guess my sister had felt bad that I had asked all my cousins to be bridesmaids. And so my dad's like, ask your sister. Here I am with my sister who's pregnant with my abuser's child. And I'm like, can you be my matron of honor? So yeah, we got married, did the BYU thing for a while.
Was Mike at your wedding?
No. At that point, it was, their marriage was still kind of weird. It was still kind of strained, even though she was pregnant. I think it took probably, you know, at least 6 or so months to where he was kind of back in the fold of the family. It's very strange. But I was glad to be in Utah and everyone to be in California, and it was good for a while. And then my husband and I, we moved back. We moved into my parents' house for the summer, and there's this family reunion going on, and I said, you know, I really don't want to go if Mike's going to be there. And my dad got so mad at me. Like, he's like, you need to forgive this guy. Like, what is going on? Why can't everyone else in the family's forgiven him? You know, you need to get over it. You're not being very Christ-like. And I'm just like, I can't make myself do it. But I felt like there was something wrong with me. Like I am evil. It was a reoccurring kind of an idea in my life where I felt like there was something kind of evil about me. And I wasn't being very Christ. Like I wasn't, you know, doing the things I needed to do. I'm not being forgiving. So, but after yelling at me for a bit, my dad then calmed down. He's like, okay, well, this time we'll make it so that Mike will be at part of the reunion. You'll be at the other part. We'll accommodate you for now, but just so you know, you're going to have to get over this. Yeah, it became a big problem for my family. I ended up staying in California, and, you know, I got pregnant by 20. I was your typical trying to be a good LDS woman. You had a baby there, trying to navigate how to work with my family, because I kept saying, I can't be around him. Like, I don't know how to make myself do it. I don't know how to be okay with it. I'm trying. I promise I'll get there, guys, but you know. And so it was always up to me to, if someone's having a birthday party or baby blessing or something, it was always up to me to call people and be like, is Mike going to be there? And if he wasn't, okay, I'm coming. And no one would say, we're not going to invite Mike this time. They say, you know, we just say everyone's welcome. Everyone's welcome. You know, we don't want to exclude anybody, but really it just felt like they didn't want to make a decision themselves. They were too scared.
What was your husband's viewpoint of all this?
I think he realized how insane it was and how crazy it was. At the same time, he's trying to be super supportive of me and what I wanted, and I wanted to be with my family. It was just, it was a very, I had a therapist later on give me a book called, Betrayal Bonds, and that's how I look at it. There was a, this weird bonding, even though I was being, there was betrayal, heavy betrayal. And I was just, I didn't know how to let it go, how to let them go, or how to reconcile everything. So he tried to be supportive of me, but he would, you know, he's always been sort of my protector. If someone like starts messing with me or, you know, yells at me from my family or, you know, where I'm, you know, in the corner crying, he's going to call them and yell at them. I mean, that's, he's always been very protective of me. So he just kind of endured everything. I don't know why or how or,
did he come in contact with Mike?
Yes. Oh my goodness. This is when we were, dating. So I was home. I was in my bedroom and my dad came in and said, and Russ was there at the house. And, my dad came in and said, Mike's here. He wants to talk to you. I said, no, I'm not going to talk to him. And, he said, he wants to apologize. I said, I don't care. I don't want to see him. And my dad and Russ were in the bedroom with me, and Mike just walks in the room. And I just look at him, he goes, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. You know, I didn't even look at him. I didn't respond. I'm just like, you're just forcing yourself on me again. Like, how is this helpful? How is this mending? So I know from my husband took everything he could not to just, you know, at that time we were dating though. So I think it was kind of a strange, he didn't know how to take it. And I'm surprised he married me after that, but we pretty much just stayed away from Mike. And I came to my dad very meek. My dad's like you know, it's a very Mormon family, very patriarchal, where my dad is in charge of everything that happens. My mom's very meek. She's doesn't get involved in decision making. She doesn't talk about feelings. She doesn't get into, it's very much a denial kind of situation in the family. It's very, that sort of heavy denial. So I came to my dad very humbly at one point and said, I just need time. I need time to where I can be at things and Mike's not going to be there. I will accept him at some point. Can you help me out in the meantime? And I guess coming to him with that approach helped because I said, okay, let's do that. And we were living in a town that was probably, and I had only my first child at this point, probably 40 minutes away from where my parents lived. And I was coming home for Christmas Eve and my dad said, okay, I'll make sure Mike's not here. And I get there and Mike's in my living room, my parents' living room. So I walk straight down to the hallway and go to my dad's room. He's sleeping. And I said, what the hell? What is Mike doing here? You said he wouldn't be here. He said, oh, I don't know. I don't know what happened. He must have come when I was sleeping. So he said, why don't you guys go drive around for a while and I will get rid of him. And keep in mind, this was like 98. We didn't have these cell phones and we had a year and a half year old in the car. And, we'd stop every, you know, few 20 minutes or 30 minutes and call from a payphone. Is he gone yet? No, he's still here. Your sister won't let him leave. She wants him to be here to open gifts with the kids. Da, da, da. So we ended up driving around for 2 hours and wait for him to leave. And it was just heartbreaking. It was just, and as soon as we got there, all of my siblings and their spouses had to leave and go to do their other things. I'm just like, what? What is, you know, I felt very rejected. So there's a lot of stories like that. A lot of times where it was just nobody wanted to cause waves. Nobody, peace at all costs is huge in my family. It's, we're not going to, you know, exclude anyone, even though they deserve it. And we're not going to talk about it. So. And then, I went into another weird, fanatical phase And I think it's really to gain my self-worth. I think that's what those phases were about. I wanted to feel a sense of being righteous and good and restore that, you know, being redeemed from something or whatever. And I started writing this, like, historical, LDS historical fiction. I look at it now and go, oh, that's such garbage. But at the time, I just thought I was being so righteous. And I'm like, I got to move to Utah. I got to be right near the, you know, the LDS publishing hub. I've got, you know, but really I was just trying to run away from my family and I was just trying to, you know, find a way to make this work. So we moved to Utah for a while with two kids. Had two more there and had a lot of more run-ins with my family where I was told I was being unrighteous and all these other things. So.
Were you and Mike active in church? Sounds like you were.
Yes.
Or not Mike, I'm sorry. Your husband, Russ.
Yes. Yes, we were active in church. Like I said, I never enjoyed church. I never liked it. But I felt like it was true. So it didn't matter if I didn't like it.
Did you ever make it to the temple?
Yes, I was endowed, went through a session 6 months after I'm married. But of course, you couldn't get sealed till the year mark. But I had, you know, gone in and took out my endowments 6 months in. So, yeah, that was a weird experience. But in some ways, I felt like it made me legitimate. Like, see, I'm a good person. I made it to the temple, even though it's really weird in there.
What part of it was weird for you?
The whole thing. I only went back maybe less than a handful of times. I felt it was so weird. I felt anxious in there. I didn't feel safe. I felt there's so much going on. I don't understand it. I don't know, you know, obviously it's so surreal when you compare it to actual church, you know, going to church on Sunday. It's a totally different world. And, I didn't like have a specific thing where I thought, oh, that's horrible, but I just didn't like the whole thing. And I think I maybe went, now keep in mind, I didn't leave till recently. I think I only went back maybe 3 or 4 times for sessions and, you know, 17 years or whatever. So I didn't enjoy it. So yeah, there was one kind of pivotal moment where, we had three kids. We were living in Park City and I wanted to go home for Christmas. It's always Christmas. This is why I have issues with Christmas now. And I, you know, called my dad. I'm like, okay, it was kind of a last minute thing. I said, we're going to come home for Christmas. You know, can you make sure Mike's not there? Kind of as a side note, I didn't think it'd be a problem. And he said, no, I'm not going to make sure he's not here. If you want to come, you're going to have to be with Mike. And I said, what? And I was just, oh my gosh, I was just devastated. And so he talked to my husband and he said, what is wrong with her? Allison, she is like in a downward spiral. She just wants to hurt people. And oh my gosh, my husband flipped out on my dad at that point. Like, what? What did you say? What did you say? She wants to hurt people? Like, what did you say? And he goes, I didn't mean it, you know, try to correct what he was saying, but it was a very, kind of one of those traumatic times where I've had a lot of depressive episodes in my life, but it's always been brought about by things like that. And that was one of those times. So I called my cousin in Tennessee, who was super true believing, super active member. And her husband was in the bishopric at that time. And she didn't know about the abuse. And I told her and she's like, come out here for Christmas, come out to Tennessee. I said, well, we can't. It's last minute. And we've got, you know, three kids and that'd be a big trip. And my husband said, okay, the day after Christmas, I want you to fly out to Tennessee. You go see your cousin. You need a break. You need to get out of here. So, I went to Tennessee and had these late night talks with them and it was like a deprogramming. That's the only way I can describe it. It was a total deprogramming. I kept defending my family to her. Like, well, I feel so sorry for them. I put them in this position. It's hard, you know? And she's like, that is not, you didn't do anything, you know, and her husband, who's a Southern guy, who's very, you know, bombastic, and he said, that's not how you do it. That's not the bishop, that's not how you do church courts. Something went wrong. You know, you should have been a witness. You were 18, you know, so it was like this week long deprogramming.
Oh, and finally someone's making some sense.
Exactly. Well, and I think it had to come from someone who was a very active believing person. If it came from someone who was just a regular person, I think I wouldn't have taken it. I mean, like, well, they don't understand. They're not Mormon. So got back, met with my bishop in Park City and told him, you know, what happened. And he's like, oh, that was botched. Like, that was a very botched church court. And I left this part out, but so my brother-in-law was disfellowshipped, but 2 months later, he was back in the temple. 3 months later, he was baptizing his daughter. So this disfellowshipment wasn't what you think of as a disfellowshipment. It was very short, not hard at all. And he said, okay, something really went wrong here, and I don't believe that you're the only victim. I think you're tip of the iceberg. He even said, when I told him what my brother-in-law did, he's like, ooh, he works with dead bodies?
Oh,
I know.
I thought of that.
I know. I'm like, yeah, that's gross. I hope he's got his limits, but who knows? And so my bishop was, he was awesome. And he's like, we're going to get on top of this. I'm going to be the stake president. We're going to take this to Salt Lake. We're going to take care of this. And so then he meets with me again. He's like, the stake president doesn't want to do anything. I'm like, what? What do I have to do? And I kind of left it. I kind of left it like that. And shortly after, my parents moved to Utah and we moved to Connecticut right after they moved to Utah. I swear my whole adult life's about been running away from dealing with them.
Did you move because they came to Utah or was it just a coincidence?
I think deep down it was a lot about them moving to Utah. I left California because it was too hard. It was too painful to deal with, like, every single family event. I've got to deal with it. I got to call people and be hurt all over again. So that's why I left for Utah. And then they come to Utah. I'm like, okay. At that point, my husband's looking for another job anyway. And so we just started scoping the country. And he got a job offer in Connecticut. I'm like, let's go. So at that point, we had 4 kids. Oh, right after my 4th kid, had a major postpartum depression, and my grandma died. She lived in the Bay Area, and I wanted to go to her funeral, but my brother-in-law was a funeral director, so at my grandma's funeral, I'm like, I can't go to my grandma's funeral. This really sucks. And Russ was so angry for me that I couldn't go to my grandma's funeral. I was already in depression. He went to my mom, who's, I told you, just very meek and doesn't confront things, and told her, because she gave him a program to my grandma's funeral. I'm like, give this to Allison. Like, and he said she would have really liked to be there. And my mom said, well, my mom requested that Mike, you know, be the one to take care of her. And Russ said, do you really think that she would request that if she'd known what Mike had done to Allison? And my mom just said, no, I guess not. It was so weird and so awful. And I was ready to get out of there. So yes, so we left for Connecticut. And then, I had my cousin in Tennessee, and she's very, you know, proactive, and she kept, you know, calling me saying, you still don't let this go. Don't let this die. Go. Poor lady. She probably doesn't realize she's the one who led me to my apostasy. Ultimately, she would be devastated. But she's like, you need to take this to the top. You need to go send a letter to the first presidency. Like, this is not okay.
So she didn't even think legal means either. She just thought through the church.
Oh, she thought I should pursue legal means. Okay. But I kept saying, I was still so indoctrinated. I kept thinking, I'll take care of the church stuff first, and then I'll deal with the state. And so I sent a couple different letters to the first presidency, like the kind, what do you call it, where they have to like sign for it. You can't, it's not just, it's like a registered letter where they have to sign, you know, the office has to sign it in and stuff. So I did that. And my cousin even printed up some herself and sent them in and did the same thing so that they would be sure to get a copy of this letter. And so I get a call in from my bishop. You know, he calls me into his office, says, so you sent a letter to the first presidency and what's this about?
And it went right back to the bishop.
Exactly. Exactly. So helpful. That's helped me in the past many times. And so he said, okay, well, now they've got their lawyers involved. They want to see if everything was done okay. And he wanted me to chronicle everything that happened, all the details, because I hadn't been a witness. And I said, oh, and here's another part of the story. I keep leaving out details. During all these years, Mike kept having callings with the youth. And I'm like, how does that work? If he's been disfellowshipped for child abuse, how is he having callings with the youth? That's not okay. So that was another point that I made in the letter to the first presidency, was that he's still dealing with kids. He's still being called. And I would be devastated to find out someone that was in a calling with my children was a known, you know, sex offender or a known, you know, child abuser. So I detailed every little everything that happened when I was abused to this bishop. And this bishop, my Park City bishop, I loved him. He was so kind, so loving. This one in Connecticut, he was so awkward, and it was uncomfortable. And there had been some kind of, like, in our ward, there'd been a child abuse sort of scandal with a brother abusing his little sister. And so he kept having this scenario in his mind of this other family, and he's talking to me, and he's trying to downplay my abuse, like saying, well, you know, like, I'm not that, this is not, that's not my situation. Stop it. Stop using that situation to think about mine. Because he kept making it sound like it was a minor thing. And so I was getting really bold with him, you know, no. It's like, okay. So yeah, they sent all this information in, and then, okay, here's where I get emotional. I get a letter from a general authority. I actually have it right next to me. This was 2009. I got it in May of 2009, so it's exactly 5 years. And, they said, that they were satisfied with how everything went. They said, you'll be happy to know he has no callings with youth right now. I'm like, how would I be happy for that? I mean, it doesn't matter. He still had callings with him. What's going to stop him in the future? And they said, basically in the letter, that hope you find some peace, you know, we're done with this issue. And it like rocked my world. I was, oh my gosh. I always say that. I keep saying it rocked my world for everything that's going on in my life. But I think that was one of the most traumatic experiences, getting that letter from the church. Cause I had such faith that the church was true, that President Monson has a direct line with God, and he would know this is not right. We need to take care of this. And it was all gone like that. What did I have left to do? Who else did I have to go to? There's no one else you can go to. You can't go any higher. So anyway, that kind of led me down this road, really. I became so disturbed by the church at that point, and yet I couldn't leave it. I started to see all of the imperfections. I started to see all of the issues, all of the way they treat some marginalized people. And I started to become angry, you know? And this is right around Prop 8 and I was just angry. And I told the bishop at Connecticut, I said, you know, this is what happened. He's like, yeah, I heard. And I said, I want to be released from my calling. I'm only going to come to sacrament to support my family. I'm not going to go to any, you know, any other meetings. He said, okay. And I couldn't get over it. I would go out on dates with my husband and be like, how do I make this work? Like, how do I end up being okay with this? How do I make this okay for me? Cause I still believe it. I guess I'm just kind of dense that way. I couldn't get over the believing part.
No, you're not dense. It's been what, 30 years at this point?
Almost.
Yeah. So it's not being dense. It's your daily life for 30 years. That's not easy to get over, get past.
Yeah. That's true. And when you've been raised in it and you've had generations in it, I think you just, I feel like I was brainwashed. So I just kept trying to go. I kept trying to make it work. I have a strained relationship with all of my family except for my little brother, whom I love. He's much younger than everyone else, so he wasn't really part of anything that was going on. He's a very liberal guy. But all the rest of them, they all let their daughter spend the night at Mike's house after knowing what he did. I mean, I can't deal with the denial in the family. So I just felt so, kind of on my own. Like my family, I don't really feel any connection to now. My church, I don't feel any connection to. So then soon after that, my husband starts his own company and we decide to move up to the Boston area, just over the border in New Hampshire, and start over in a different ward. I think this is what I need. I need a fresh start. I need a new ward. And had normal callings for a while. And then January of, not this last year, January before, I guess 2013, I was asked to be in the Relief Society presidency. And see, at this point, I don't know what I believe as far as what exists and what doesn't exist and what, you know, but I'm kind of like, I've heard John DeLynn say things like where he doesn't know if God exists or not, but there's been times where he's felt like there's been something leading or something. That's what I felt this time. And when I was asked to be in the Relief Society presidency, I had this thought like just hit me that this is it. This is your answer. You're going to find out now if you should stay in the church or not. Take the calling. So maybe it was for me, but it felt like important. So I took the calling and it was awful, really awful. I loved the president, really say president. She was awesome, but I was depressed every time I came home from the meetings. I was frustrated at realizing just how little power women have in the church. The bishop had decided to micromanage us and say, you guys need to meet twice a month instead of once. And, you know, keep in mind, we all live very far apart up here. It's not like, you know, it takes us half an hour to get to the church house. I mean, it's not like we're all like in the same neighborhood. And she said, I don't think that's necessary, bishop, you know. I said, no, you're going to do it. I'm like, what the? We have no power. We have no say at anything. Like, there is nothing a woman can do in church. At this point, I was getting upset that, you know, women have to go and talk to the bishop about sex, about their, you know, their abuse or their so-called sins. That just started to get to me. All this stuff started building up and building up and building up. And I was becoming a feminist in the church. I was angry about how homosexuals were treated. I was angry about everything. And it was just really it got to a point where, hey, let's look at the history of the church. So, that's when I started to look into Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon and all from very safe sources to begin with. I was, you know, talking to my little brother and I said, you know, he knew I was struggling. So he had me listen to this Mormon Stories podcast about, you know, faith transitions and about how, and Jonah Brooks said something about like, it's okay to take a sabbatical. And I'm like, oh. Like, really? I could take a break? I don't have to like make a decision like black and white right now. I'm in, I'm out. I can like take a break. And it's like, it was the first time it occurred to me. So I'm like, oh, we need to take a break. We really need to take a break. And I left the country for a trip with a friend. And then I came back and my 16-year-old daughter told me that she had the bishop had called her in and asked her if she masturbated. And I said, no. Like, no. I didn't like the guy to begin with because he wasn't, you know, I mean, and then to take in a child, no, she wasn't little, but she's a child with a middle-aged man, a 50-something-year-old man, asking if she masturbates. I mean, that's just not.
In a room by themselves.
Yeah. And that's what I hate about the church is that they didn't ask me or my husband, oh, can we talk to your daughter? He just pulled her out of, you know, class or whatever. It's like they feel like they have the right to do whatever they want with your kids, whenever they want. They don't have to ask permission, you know? And I was like, no, I can't do this anymore. I can't. My husband, I started sending him, I got involved with all those like Facebook groups, you know, all those, you know, progressively getting more and more, post-Mormon kind of stuff or ex-Mormon kind of stuff. And I'd send links to my husband and he was, you know, when I got that letter, he was already, I think that did major damage to him too. You know, he was already prepped for this just like I was, you know, already dissatisfied. And so he would, you know, look at the links I'd send him that I'd see on these Facebook groups or I started getting to podcasts and so I'd send him links and there'd be one or two times where he kind of like, well, you know, want to look at the other side, but he was never like outright like, no, this is wrong. You know, he was very open-minded to hearing about this. And then we both read Grant Palmer's
view of Mormon.
Yes, Mormon Origins. Yeah.
Yeah, Mormon Origins.
And my husband travels a lot. So he came home and he said, nope, it's not true. I don't believe it anymore. So in August, you know, I'd been called to my calling in January. By August, I was like, I said it out loud, admitted it. I don't believe it's true. It was such a weird feeling to admit that. It was devastating, but it was weird and freeing. And I thought, okay, do I ask to be released from my calling? And I had a feeling that I didn't need to be asked to be released. I was going to be released before the end of the year. I don't know where that feeling came from. I tell you, I don't know what happened there, but in October, we had this like surprise sort of like state conference and they changed the boundaries. They announced this thing and all of a sudden our Relief Society president was a different ward. I'm like, oh, this is it. And when they called the new presidency, I wasn't called back. So I'm out. I'm free. So we've been out since October. So it's been about 7 months. And, it's been, my husband, it's been very even for him, very, he hasn't had like a lot of traumatic feelings about it, but I have. I mean, I've had a lot of grieving, a lot of processing, a lot of mourning about it, but also happiness and freedom and not hating my life that I have to go to church every Sunday. And that's a 4-hour ordeal with driving. So, and I never enjoyed it, like I said. So we've been out since October and, it's been good overall.
Do your children still go?
No, they don't. We sat them down over Thanksgiving break and said, it's not true. Like, this church isn't true. Sorry, kids. Sorry we indoctrinated you. We talked about Joseph Smith. We don't think he got any golden plates. We don't believe he, you know, saw an angel. We don't believe any of this. And so we aren't going to go to church anymore. And my 16-year-old, she goes, oh, I'm so relieved. I have never believed it. And she said, I was planning on going to college and trying out other churches without telling you. So, you know, it's nice that we didn't have to deal with, you know, strained, you know, relationships with her going to different church and us feeling, you know, there's only one option in life. So, and the other kids, you know, we've got a 14-year-old son and we've got our daughter just turned 12 in April and then a 9-year-old boy. So they all got baptized. but they all seem happy about it.
You all got out.
Yeah, we all got out. And, I was thinking it's funny today. I just noticed that I was looking at my letter from general authorities that I got in 09, and it's dated May 18th. And I was looking at my ancestor Austin Cole's history today, and he was excommunicated for apostasy on May 18th. So I just find it ironic that the letter I got that led to my apostasy came on the same date that he was actually excommunicated. So I don't know. There's some kind of full circle moment about it or something.
Austin's probably happy for you.
Yeah. If there is an afterlife, he's probably cheering right now.
And does your family know about your change in beliefs?
No. We are writing our letter this weekend. So.
Oh, wow. We need to have you back. See how that went.
Well, yes. And my husband's family is very true believing, very Provo BYU family. So I have no idea what their reaction will be. I think I've held off telling my family because I know that they're going to say, see what happens when you are angry and you don't forgive. This is what happens. It'll be on my shoulders again. So I think that's why I've resisted telling them. But with my daughter just turning 12 and them expecting her to be in the women's program, and I have to do this. I have to just be done. I don't like keeping secrets. It's been the theme of my life to keep secrets, and I don't like keeping secrets anymore. I'm done with that. So.
Good luck with the letter. I hope it goes well. One thing I've found is that with my own family members and other people I've talked to, that oftentimes they're surprised by family, that they react better than they thought. So mm-hmm. I hope that's true for you and your husband's family.
Well, thank you. Well, and I living thousands of miles away from all of them kind of helps too. So.
Yeah, that does help.
But yeah, we're looking forward to having it be out, be ourselves, be open. So.
Okay. Would you mind giving some advice to anyone that has gone through something like you?
Oh my gosh. Do not blame yourself. I mean, it's hard because I thought I didn't blame myself. I assumed, I was like, no, I didn't do anything wrong. But internally, I really did. I really took on a lot of shame, a lot of guilt, a lot of those horrible lessons I internalized and didn't realize it. So find your voice. You know, I started writing, you know, I've written my whole life, but I started writing about this. And it helps so much just to tell your story, just to know there's other people out there. You know, I started a blog writing about my abuse and, much to my family's dismay. And I got so many emails from women all over the country who are LDS who, this is before I left the church, who would say, I've been abused by my husband. My bishop told me to stay with them. I've been this and that. And just people reaching out and traumatized and hurt. And it's gotta stop. Like it's not okay. And that's what, I mean, even though I don't believe anymore, that's why I believe in, I support ordained women, because women cannot, we can't be treated like this anymore. We need people in charge, like the Mormons need people in charge that are women, that are in there, that are, I think that's just so important, you know?
What about the person that would want to get help? Where would you suggest they go for help?
That's hard because I went to the people I thought would be perfect. My bishop and my family. It didn't work out. Someone you trust. Someone who could be an advocate. I think my cousin was one of those people that was, I've always been kind of, nah, whatever happens, happens. I haven't been, you know, rallying, you know, kind of person. And to go to someone like that who will take your, you know, take it and run with it and call the police, call the, you know, whoever. I waited too late. I got involved. I tried to civilly sue Mike, and in California, I couldn't. I'd been diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and my diagnosis had been too far back for me to be able to sue him or anything. And the statute of limitations is ridiculous, but just go to someone who you think would be an advocate for you. If you're scared to go to the police, but go to the police by all means, because the church is not necessarily looking out for you. I think their main purpose is to protect the church. I think that's always their main concern. And if your story hurts them, they want to squash those things. So, if you want to reach out to me, reach out to me. Anyone who's got problems, because I find it, I find it so healing to hear other people and for them to know that they're not alone and I'm not alone. And I just think that's really important to reach out.
Okay. And what's your blog? Do you want to put that out there?
I'm trying to think. I haven't written in that one for a long time. I'm trying to remember that address. Gosh.
That's okay.
I write one that's about New England now, and I kind of stopped on that one for the time being. But I've recently been writing about my depression and my abuse. I've gotten a couple emails from active members saying, we don't teach that in church.
Yeah.
But that one's newenglandliving.com or .org. But I do have... I have an email there if anyone wants to reach me, because I now openly talk about it on that blog as well. But
okay.
my other one was, I can't remember the address now. I think it was, I can't remember the address of the one.
Okay. Well, that'll work then if somebody wants to get in touch with you.
Yeah.
That was newenglandliving.org?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, great. It sounds like you've been able to find some peace finally.
Yeah, I finally feel like I'm coming to terms with my life, finally in my late 30s. Feels good, though.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Alice, and I think that your podcast will help others, because unfortunately there's lots of them out there.
Yeah, well, thank you.
All right, thanks. If you are interested in being a guest on Mormon Expression, feel free to email me at voices@mormonexpression.com. And you can also visit us at the website mormonexpression.com, where we have information on therapists and other resources to help you with any way we can help. So thanks again, Allison.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.